two nights after, his friends came to see him. She brought them up to his bedroom, the air of which was impregnated with a personal odour, and gave them chairs at the fire. Mr. Kernan's tongue, the occasional stinging pain of which had made him somewhat irritable during the day, became more polite. He sat propped up in the bed by pillows, and the little colour in his puffy cheeks made them resemble warm cinders. He apologised to his guests for the disorder of the room, but at the same time looked at them a little proudly, with a veteran's pride. He was quite unconscious that he was the victim of a plot, which his friends, Mr. Cunningham, Mr. McCoy, and Mr. Power, had disclosed to Mrs. Kernan in the parlour. The idea had been Mr. Power's, but its development was entrusted to Mr. Cunningham. Mr. Kernan came of Protestant stock, and, though he had been converted to the Catholic faith at the time of his marriage, he had not been in the pale of the church for 20 years. He was fond, moreover, of giving side thrusts at Catholicism. Mr. Cunningham was the very man for such a case. He was an elder colleague of Mr. Power's. His own domestic life was not very happy. People had great sympathy with him, for it was known that he had married an unpresentable woman who was an incurable drunkard. He had set up house for her 6 times, and each time she had pawned the furniture on him. Everyone had respect for poor Martin Cunningham. He was a thoroughly sensible man, influential and intelligent. His blade of human knowledge, natural astuteness, particularised by long association with cases in the police courts, had been tempered by brief immersions in the waters of general philosophy. He was well informed. His friends bowed to his opinions and considered that his face was like Shakespeare's. When the plot had been disclosed to her, Mrs. Kernan had said, "I leave it all in your hands, Mr. Cunningham." After a quarter of a century of married life, she had very few illusions left. Religion for her was a habit, and she suspected that a man of her husband's age would not change greatly before death. She was tempted to see a curious appropriateness in his accident, and, but that she did not wish to seem bloody-minded, she would have told the gentleman that Mr. Kernan's tongue would not suffer by being shortened. However, Mr. Cunningham was a capable man, and religion was religion. The scheme might do good, and at least it could do no harm. Her beliefs were not extravagant. She believed steadily in the Sacred Heart as the most generally useful of all Catholic devotions, and approved of the sacraments. Her faith was bounded by her kitchen, but if she was put to it, she could believe also in the Banshee and in the Holy Ghost. The gentleman began to talk of the accident. Mr. Cunningham said that he had once known a similar case. A man of 70 had bitten off a piece of his tongue during an epileptic fit, and the tongue had filled in again so that no one could see a trace of the bite. "Well, I'm not 70, said the invalid. "God forbid," said Mr. Cunningham. "It doesn't pain you now?" asked Mr. McCoy. Mr. McCoy had been at one time a tenor of some reputation. His wife, who had been a soprano, still taught young children to play the piano at low terms. His line of life had not been the shortest distance between 2 points, and for short periods he had been driven to live by his wits. He had been a clerk in the Midland Railway, a canvasser for advertisements for the Irish Times and for the Freeman's Journal, a town traveller for a coal firm on commission, a private inquiry agent, a clerk in the office of the sub-sheriff, and he had recently become secretary to the city coroner. His new office made him professionally interested in Mr. Kernan's case. "Pain? Not much," answered Mr. Kernan. "But it's so sickening. I feel as if I wanted to retch off." "That's the booze," said Mr. Cunningham firmly. "No," said Mr. Kernan. "I think I caught a cold on the car. There's something keeps coming into my throat. Phlegm or mucus," said Mr. McCoy. "It keeps coming like from down in my throat. Sickening thing. Yes, yes, said Mr. McCoy. That's the thorax. He looked at Mr. Cunningham and Mr. Power at the same time with an air of challenge. Mr. Cunningham nodded his head rapidly, and Mr. Power said, Ah, well, all's well that ends well. I'm very much obliged to you, old man, said the invalid. Mr. Power waved his hand. Those are the two fellows I was with. Who were you with? Asked Mr. Cunningham. A chap. I don't know his name. Damn it, now, what's his name? Little chap with sandy hair. And who else? Said Mr. Cunningham. When Mr. Cunningham made that remark, people were silent. It was known that the speaker had secret sources of information. In this case, the monosyllable had a moral intention. Mr. Harford sometimes formed one of a little detachment which left the city shortly after noon on Sunday with the purpose of arriving as soon as possible at some public house on the outskirts of the city where its members duly qualified themselves as bona fide travellers. But his fellow travellers had never consented to overlook his origin. He had begun life as an obscure financier by lending small sums of money to workmen at usurious interest. Later on, he'd become the partner of a very fat, short gentleman, Mr. Goldberg, in the Liffey Loan Bank. Though he had never embraced more than the Jewish ethical code, his fellow Catholics, whenever they had smarted in person or by proxy under his exactions, spoke of him bitterly as an Irish Jew and an illiterate, and saw divine disapproval of usury made manifest through the person of his idiot son. At other times they remembered his good points. "I wonder where did he go to?" said Mr. Kernan. He wished the details of the incident to remain vague. He wished his friends to think there had been some mistake, that Mr. Harford and he had missed each other. His friends, who knew quite well Mr. Harford's manners in drinking, were silent. Mr. Power said again, All's well that ends well. Mr. Kernan changed the subject at once. That was a decent young chap, that medical fellow, he said. Only for him. Oh, only for him, said Mr. Power. It might have been a case of 7 days without the option of a fine. Yes, yes, said Mr. Kernan, trying to remember. I remember now there was a policeman. Decent young fella, he seemed. How did it happen at all? It happened that you were Peluther Tom, said Mr. Cunningham gravely. True, Bill, said Mr. Kernan, equally gravely. I suppose you squared the constable, Jack, said Mr. McCoy. Mr. Power did not relish the use of his Christian name. He was not straight-laced, but he could not forget that Mr. McCoy had recently made a crusade in search of valises and portmanteaus to enable Mrs. McCoy to fulfil imaginary engagements in the country. More than he resented the fact that he had been victimised, he resented such low playing of the game. He answered the question, therefore, as if Mr. Kernan had asked it. The narrative made Mr. Kernan indignant. He was keenly conscious of his citizenship, wished to live with his city on terms mutually honourable, and resented any affront put upon him by those whom he called country bumpkins. Is this what we pay rates for? He asked. To feed and clothe these ignorant bustoons, and they're nothing else? Mr. Cunningham laughed. He was a castle official only during office hours. How could they be anything else, Tom? He said. He assumed a thick provincial accent and said in a tone of command, 65, catch a cabbage. Everyone laughed. Mr. McCoy, who wanted to enter the conversation by any door, pretended that he had never heard the story. Mr. Cunningham said, It is supposed, they say, you know, to take place in the depot where they get these thundering big country fellows, or Martins, you know, to drill. The sergeant makes them stand in a row against the wall and hold up their plates. He illustrated the story by grotesque gestures. A dinner, you know. Then he has a bloody big bowl of cabbage before him on the table and a bloody big spoon like a shovel. He takes up a wad of cabbage on the spoon and pegs it across the room, and the poor devils have to try and catch it on their plates. 65, catch your cabbage! Everyone laughed again. But Mr. Kernan was somewhat indignant still. He talked of writing a letter to the papers. "These yahoos coming up here," he said, "think they can boss the people. I needn't tell you, Martin, what kind of men they are." Mr. Cunningham gave a qualified assent. "It's like everything else in this world," he said. "You get some bad ones, and you get some good ones." "Oh, yes, you get some good ones, I admit," said Mr. Kernan, satisfied. "It's better to have nothing to say to them," said Mr. McCoy. "That's my opinion." Mrs. Kernan entered the room and, placing a tray on the table, said, "Help yourselves, gentlemen." Mr. Power stood up to officiate, offering her his chair. She declined it, saying that she was ironing downstairs, and, after having exchanged a nod with Mr. Cunningham behind Mr. Power's back, prepared to leave the room. Her husband called out to her, "And have you nothing for me, ducky?" "Oh, you! The back of my hand to you," said Mrs. Kernan tartly. Her husband called after her, "Nothing for poor little hubby." He assumed such a comical face and voice that the distribution of the bottles of stout took place amid general merriment. The gentlemen drank from their glasses, set the glasses again on the table, and paused. Then Mr. Cunningham turned towards Mr. Power and said casually, "On Thursday night, you said, Jack?"
"Thursday, yes," said Mr. Power.
"Righto," said Mr. Cunningham promptly.
"We can meet in Macaulay's," said Mr. McCoy. "That'll be the most convenient place."
"But we mustn't be late," said Mr. Power earnestly, "because it's sure to be crammed to the doors."
"We can meet at 7:30, said Mr. McCoy.
"Righto," said Mr. Cunningham. 7:30 at Macaulay's be it." There was a short silence. Mr. Kernan waited to see whether he would be taken into his friend's confidence. Then he asked,
"What's in the wind?"
"Oh, it's nothing," said Mr. Cunningham. "It's only a little matter that we're arranging about for Thursday."
"The opera, is it?" said Mr. Kernan.
"No, no," said Mr. Cunningham in an evasive tone. "It's just a little spiritual matter." "Oh," said Mr. Kernan. There was silence again. Then Mr. Power said point blank, "To tell you the truth, Tom, we're going to make a retreat."
"Yes, that's it," said Mr. Cunningham. "Jack and I and McCoy here, we're all going to wash the pot."
He uttered the metaphor with a certain homely energy, and, encouraged by his own voice, proceeded.
"You see, we may as well all admit we're a nice collection of scoundrels, one and all.
I say one and all," he added with a gruff charity, and turning to Mr. Power, "own up now."
"I own up," said Mr. Power.
"And I own up," said Mr. McCoy.
"So we're going to wash the pot together," said Mr. Cunningham.
A thought seemed to strike him. He turned suddenly to the invalid and said,
"Do you know what, Tom, has just occurred to me? You might join in and we'd have a four-handed reel."
"Good idea," said Mr. Power. "The four of us together.